We learn from our president that change we need is not easy.
Every time we come close to passing health insurance reform, the special interests fight back with everything they've got.
Okay. We've just had a demonstration of democracy. Okay.
Meanwhile, Senator Arlen Specter learns that nothing is easy about health care. Brother, can you spare some change? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Oh, yeah, we're looking for spare change. Good morning. It's Wednesday, August 12th. I'm John Huckenberry, joined by Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, John.
Coming up in the show this hour, is running actually good for your knees? Kind of a use-it-or-lose-it thing, we'll find out. Michael Vick, he's out of prison, but how likely is it that he'll play? Looking more likely. Move over, France. American-made cheese is taking its share of the limelight. But first, we're joined once again by Corey Lewandowski, New Hampshire State Director for Americans for Prosperity. That's an advocacy organization. He was at Obama's town meeting in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, yesterday afternoon. Corey, do you recognize this sound here?
Here we go. Fight's on.
Corey?
I don't know it well if I know it.
You don't know if you know it?
I don't think I do.
Well, that was not the sound of protests outside the Obama town meeting. That was the sound of the bench-clearing brawl at Fenway Park with the Boston Red Sox against
Comerica
the Detroit Tigers.
Park.
Yeah. Was it a Comerica?
Wasn't it?
In any case, it was a little tame outside the town meeting, Corey. How do you explain that?
Well, inside the town meeting was tame because the president limited access, so he had a very friendly audience. Outside the town meeting was significantly more exciting, where the unions bust in three loads of people and were there to support their president. And then the grassroots were there to make sure that the president understood that we can't afford another $1 trillion piece of legislation.
Well, the brawling stayed at Fenway Park, and you're such a Detroiter. You're Comerica Park. No,
I'm just glad the fighting wasn't in Detroit. That's all I can say.
It's a testimony to democracy. Stick around, Corey. We'll be back with you in a minute to talk about what happened yesterday. It's all about controlling the message in healthcare. But first, a look at some of the morning's other top headlines.
U.S. Marines are meeting heavy resistance as they fight to take a Taliban-held town in southern Afghanistan. They want the town under control before the presidential elections next week. On to Africa, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Nigeria. She's expected to take a tough stance on reform when she meets with the country's president later today. Oil profits have fueled corruption there.
In Taiwan, rescuers have found nearly 1,000 missing people alive. That's a positive story. After Wall Street suffered its biggest loss in 5 weeks yesterday, all indices fell more than 1%. Asian markets also dropped, but the Dow opens today at 9241. The S&P opens at 994, and the Nasdaq kicks off at 1970. Control the message on healthcare. We gave you that invitation.
This is Michelle calling from Atlanta. I'm trying to understand why there's so much discussion about end-of-life care. Anyone that's living should have something in place as far as a health care director or a will, anything in place to take care of themselves. So why is this such a foreign conversation?
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Dispel a myth or give us an issue you think is the most important, like our listener from Atlanta. You know how to reach us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
It's like CNN has discovered angry people in covering.
Yeah, I just saw they said
debate.
Real Americans sound off.
Real
as opposed to the fake ones.
Americans. I'm John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. We're trying to make sense of the debate on health care, which is actually kind of difficult because you've got statements of myth and exaggeration coupled
with
detailed policy wonkism. It's a challenge.
It is. It's very difficult to separate the emotions and the passions from the actual details of what's being proposed.
Which is often the challenge in Congress, but President Obama attempted to take the bull by the horns yesterday at his town meeting in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We're going to talk about that in a moment with Kathleen Hall Jamieson, but we want to invite you to dispel your favorite, I guess that's Maybe the one that annoys you the most, the least favorite healthcare myth. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want you to get control of the message like the president tried to do last night yesterday afternoon in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Every time we come close to passing health insurance reform, the special interests fight back with everything they've got. They use their inference. They use their political allies to scare and mislead the American people. They start running ads. This is what they always do. We can't let them do it again. Not this time. Not now.
Well, of course, the president of the United States has some political influence and some political allies as well. So is it a fair fight? Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, the natural choice to join the program this morning and give us an idea of where the message stands and how the president did. First of all, what was your overall impression?
Well, first, it was a very effective town hall, in part because it puts in place visuals of individuals who are respectful and overall supportive of this legislation at a time in which the danger for those advocating reform is that the visuals of disrupted meetings will suggest the typicality of those individuals opposing it, and as a result suggest that the public actually opposes the effort. Now, the danger on the other side, of course, is you look at yesterday's town hall and say, unrepresentative individuals are now leading to the generalization that everybody does support it. The other thing that's important about the clip...
But hold on there. It sounds like what you're saying is, at least in the early going, the impression of a tame, constructive town meeting delivers a stronger message than the disruptions we've seen over the last few weeks.
It conveys an alternative message. Essentially, the danger right now for the process is that individuals at meetings are seen by the public watching this as representative of the public as a whole. And if you take the disruptions, which have been featured in news extensively in the last days, and you as an individual sitting at home say there is a massive effort that is there but representative of public opinion, not of certain interest groups, that opposes the bill, you will think perhaps I shouldn't support the bill as well. Perhaps there's something wrong with the bill. The president, before he says a word, is suggesting a large group of people applauding him, hence implicitly the bill, are there as well. Hence, at least suspend your judgment about what public opinion says, which is actually a good idea right now, since public opinion is probably very confused in the presence of five different bills and a whole lot of claims and counterclaims.
So to cut through the confusion, the president basically puts on the one hand scare tactics, on the other hand, the status quo isn't working. Here's the sort of rhetorical opening flourish here.
Because for all the scare tactics out there, what is truly scary, what is truly risky, is if we do nothing. If we let this moment pass, if we keep the system the way it is right now, we will continue to see 14,000 Americans lose their health insurance every day.
Now, is he taking a risk here, Kathleen, that Americans see it the way he does here?
What he's trying to do is to make more salient a future in which nothing is done. And the reason that that is so important is that the majority in the United States have health insurance. And if you don't persuade them that there is something in this that is good for them, indeed indispensable for them, you're not going to shape public opinion to support ultimate legislation. And so by arguing that 14,000 will continue to lose insurance, premium caps, premiums will continue to go up, you're going to increasingly grow the deficit. What he's suggesting is that you shouldn't sit by the sidelines if you're currently insured. He then tries to lay in place what his world will look like if, in fact, you pass the reform he advocates. If he sells it, if those with insurance believe it, health care reform is not simply going to pass, it's going to be accepted.
And here's the president insisting he has political allies, and powerful ones at that.
We have the AARP on board because they know this is a good deal for our seniors.
Now, in the interest of fact-checking, Chief Operating Officer of the AARP, Tom Nelson, says yesterday that the group hasn't endorsed any of the bills, so it's a little unclear what the president is saying there, but what do you make of that statement?
It's called a universal rebuttal if, in fact, it's accurate, and the problem is, at this point, it's not yet accurate. If one can say to seniors, don't worry, any
argument you hear against bills can't be true. You're not going to be hurt by them. Medicare is not going to be cut. How do you know that? Because AARP wouldn't support it if that were true. The simple fact that the endorsement is the rebuttal. Unfortunately for the president, it's not yet true that AARP has endorsed any of the five bills currently moving through Congress.
You know, it seems to me the virulent or the strident opposition to the president here takes two forms. People who are worried about Medicare going away and people who are worried about government intervention. Those are contradictory opinions because, of course, Medicare is government intervention. And the president insists that Medicare is fine. He also insists that the government isn't going to come in and meddle. Let's listen to Obama sort of iterating all of the sort of reassuring points that he hopes he can sell here.
Under the reform we're proposing, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. If you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan. You will not be waiting in any lines. This is not about putting the government in charge of your health insurance. I don't believe anyone should be in charge of your health insurance decisions but you and your doctor. I don't think government bureaucrats should be meddling, but I also don't think insurance company bureaucrats should be meddling. That's the healthcare system I believe in.
So quickly, Kathleen, a little long for a soundbite, about 32 seconds, but does it stick?
Throughout the whole of the town hall, the president is using insurance companies as the replacement for government bureaucrats. Insurance companies are the problem, and he's talking importantly about health insurance reform, not health care reform. If you accept that the problem is an insurance, then government bureaucrats become less problematic.
The rhetorical battle is joined, best explained there by Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
That is the sound of protesters yesterday in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, outside the high school where President Obama was talking about health care reform. Yesterday morning, we spoke with Judy Ullman, a New Hampshire teacher who was attending the health care town hall. And we also talked with Corey Lewandowski, who organized an anti-Obama protest outside the town hall meeting. They're both back this morning for a debriefing. Welcome back to the show. Corey, what did you chant yesterday?
Hands off my health care. That's our message. Hands off my health care. And don't let the government get between you and your doctor.
Okay. And Judy, you were inside the town hall meeting. Corey earlier said that it was kind of set up to be a respectful meeting because there was nobody that disagreed. Was that your impression from inside?
My experience, good morning. My experience from inside was that not everybody agreed at all, but it was respectful. And in that sense, it seemed to me to be a model of the kind of discussion we all want to be involved in. Brawls don't settle a problem as deep as this.
Okay. Corey, you guys didn't have a brawl out there, but you did have some very passionate protesters with some pretty striking messages and chants and signs. Do you feel like your message got out in a positive way, in an effective way?
Well, you know, I think overall people are disappointed that the president's motorcade didn't come by where the protesters were. He snuck in the back to avoid the protesters, both in and out. You know, to be fair, the media has done a good job of covering our position. However, this was a staged town hall event, obviously. They limited the amount of people that could get inside. They didn't want real discussion. They didn't want real
debate.
Well,
you can't, I'm sorry, Corey, you can't really blame them for limiting the amount of, I mean, there are fire restrictions on how many people can be inside a room.
The facility held 2,500 people. They put 1,800 people inside the facility. We had a 1,000-person protest outside, if that tells you how visceral of an issue this is. And, you know, they limited the access to the people strictly based on vetting them, and the decision came directly from the White House, which has never been the New Hampshire way.
That's Corey Lewandowski. He's with Americans for Prosperity. He was an organizer of the protests yesterday. We are also joined by Judy Ullman. She's a teacher at a community college and was at the town hall inside yesterday. And now we'll take a look at some of the top news stories that we're covering. John?
Well, before we do that, you've been taking control of the health care issue. We've invited you to the town meeting.
There are very few absolutes in economics. One of them is that when any entity saves money, some other entity loses money, except the administration and others are avoiding that hard truth. You have to admit who you're going to take revenue away from.
Dispel a myth or give us an issue you want people to remember in the healthcare debate at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley, here all week with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste.
Torn ligaments, arthritis, achy joints.
I'm just saying this is
what could happen to you if you run for too long, right? That's the assumption.
Run.
If you're a marathon, if you run marathons, eventually the cartilage is going to wear out in your knees. All kind of horrible things are going to happen to your joints. That's the assumed wisdom. But fitness writer Gretchen Reynolds tells us that new research shows running actually might be good for your knees. She's a freelance writer and author of a weekly fitness column in the New York Times Magazine. Gretchen, welcome.
Good morning.
See, now you're claiming something which, frankly, I find very difficult to believe. You're saying running could be good for your knees, and that's certainly against everything we've been told for as long as I've been alive.
It's against a whole lot that I've been told because I run, and everyone tells me I'm going to ruin my knees. But the latest science is very compelling that in many ways, running seems to actually be protective against arthritis. And in this case, we are talking about arthritis of the knees, which is what most people do mean when they tell you running is going to ruin your knees. But there have been a couple of fairly substantial studies that suggest that even marathoning, which tends to be involve a great deal of running, actually seems to provide some protection against knee problems. The group of scientists actually over in Austria did a really interesting study in which they did MRIs of the knees of a group of marathoners. And they did it 10 years ago, and then they did another set of MRIs 10 years later. And most of the runners had continued to run marathons that whole time. And what the MRIs showed was that the knees were no worse than they had ever been, and they were actually healthier than the knees of the one runner who
Yeah, the one guy stopped running and his knees were a mess, right?
Exactly. And the scientists speculated that he would have been better off to actually keep running. It probably would have been better for his knees.
Now, the difference here is that if you've had a knee injury, then running is bad, right?
Particularly, especially if you've torn your ACL, which
is a ligament in your knee.
Yes, one of the ligaments in the knees. And that tends to make your knee no longer be in alignment. Knees actually are made for running. They're really quite good at it. But if you have seriously hurt your knee, particularly if you've torn a ligament, then your knee tends to no longer be in exactly the right alignment. And then what happens is when you run, you do start wearing away the cartilage. And then you can wind up with osteoarthritis, which is bone-on-bone arthritis. The bones are no longer cushioned at all, and it's usually quite painful.
Well, this is certainly going to remove the excuse a lot of people have for not getting some exercise. Freelance writer Gretchen Reynolds, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
Bottom of the second inning, and Youkilis is in, and Youkilis is going to go to the mound. Here we go. Fights on at Fenway.
Call it a two-day brawl at Fenway Park between the Boston Red Sox and the Detroit Tigers. We alluded to it at the top of the hour. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is with us, Takeaway sports blogger. That was a big deal.
Well, it was a little pansy-like as well. It wasn't really a fight. It was like a tackle.
But, the AL East is all about passions and violence, at least this morning. But perhaps the biggest story this morning is about another issue of violence in sports. Coming out of jail, Michael Vick looking for work in the NFL, and it's caused a controversy in Washington, D.C., because a cartoonist has taken up the issue and suddenly charges of race. Explain, Ibrahim.
Well, the comic, his name is Jeff Millar, and he has a comic called Tank McNamara, basically it depicts Roger Goodell, who's the NFL commissioner, on the phone with different characters, different people, talking about whether what they should do in a Michael Vick situation. And the controversy begins when he's on the phone with Dick Cheney, and Dick Cheney says, kill him.
So that scene is motivated, presumably, by the fact that Vic is in the news. He's out of prison after 2 years. He was convicted of felony charges for running a dog fighting ring and allegations of animal cruelty. But why the racial charge here?
I think it's the Henry Louis Gates and Obama beer gate backdrop that comes in where the nation is talking about race. And I think when you get Michael Vick and a group of white men that control his fate, I think the race conversation definitely comes into it without a doubt.
Now, the Washington Post is the only paper to ban Tank McNamara, which is the strip in question here. Jeff Miller is the writer of that nationally syndicated comic strip. We reached him yesterday, and he explained that his joke was just misinterpreted.
Some people have interpreted that as this is a white man saying kill Michael Vick, a specific black person. But this is about a ready solution that people who misuse power keep always at hand to satisfy difficult situations, especially when they believe they own the law. Mr. Cheney seems destined 3 or 4 years down the road to have, might be on trial himself.
Is this a matter of the Washington Post being way too squeamish or Michael Vick being just too hot to handle? It's an incendiary media story right now.
I think it's also a matter of those things as well. But I think in D.C., I think it's a little bit of a touchy subject to go after the former vice president, even though he might, as he suggested, be someone that gets in trouble later on.
Well, here's the last sort of word we heard out of Michael Vick, who was sort of technically reinstated last month. It's not clear where he's going to play, but he certainly said this very, very clearly on August 7th, 2007.
First, I want to apologize, you know, for all the things that I've done and that I've allowed to happen. I want to personally apologize to Commissioner Goodell, and what I did was very immature, so that means I need to grow up.
He's going to be growing up amidst this extraordinary notoriety, yet with Tony Dungy, his mentor here, former NFL coach, he's in pretty good hands, would you say?
Tony Dungy is the perfect ambassador and the perfect interpreter between the culture that Michael Vick comes from and the culture that runs and will make the decision about his fate.
And the controversy is, you know, at a fever pitch. We found some reaction from some quarters to Michael Vick being reinstated in the NFL. Okay, that's absurd. Dogs are not happy with Michael Vick coming back, but the NFL probably will be.
Well, there's going to be some fallout if you sign him. There's going to be a lot of protests. But you have to remember, Michael Vick was the first quarterback to rush for over 1,000 yards and pass for over 2,000 yards.
Right.
He was once the NFL's highest paid quarterback. He's a great talent, and he'll fit in on some squad.
And just for the record, I'm not making fun of animal cruelty. Now, finally, the big sports story in Mexico, the United States, soccer, quickly.
Yes, an Azteca field at an altitude of 7,000 feet, the smog, 105,000 fans.
If the U.S. wins, they go to the World Cup, right?
Well, they're probably going to go anyway, but if they win, they have bragging rights for North America.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Celeste Headlee. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit to Nigeria today. But first, some of the top stories we're following. John?
Well, Celeste, U.S. Marines are encountering heavy resistance as they try to take control of a Taliban-held town in southern Afghanistan. Here's Captain Zachary Martin on the goals for the town of Dahana.
All of the smaller towns are economically dependent on Dahana. For example, this is where the bazaar is. So by liberating Dahna, we free the local populace from the influence of the Taliban.
The Marines want to beat back insurgents ahead of the Afghan presidential election next week. Moving next door to Pakistan, up to 70 fighters are dead after clashes between rival militant groups in the northwest. Intelligence officials say the battle is between fighters supporting Fethullah Massoud and those allied with the government. Top Taliban leader Massoud is believed dead after an earlier CIA drone strike.
Iraq's health ministry says 67 American troops there have H1N1 or swine flu. They say they're getting those updates from the U.S. military. Iraqi health officials are trying to control the spread of the disease.
That must be miserable, having the flu in the middle of Baghdad. Back in the U.S., firefighters are battling two separate wildfires in California. So far, they've contained only 10% in Santa Barbara County. And in the northern part of the state, a separate wildfire has injured 15 firefighters. That's two-thirds contained. Those are some of the top stories we're following today.
And another story we're following is the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. She's traveling through Africa, and she arrived in Nigeria last night. While she's there, she's emphasizing the need to clamp down on government corruption and end the attacks on the oil industry there that's kept their output down. We spoke earlier this morning to BBC correspondent Carolyn Duffield about Secretary of State Clinton's trip to Nigeria, but also about Congo, the country that she just left. She really emphasized the need there to end sexual violence, and she's committed $17 million towards the effort. She's going to give video cameras to rape victims to help protect themselves from sexual attacks. We started the conversation with Carolyn Duffield by asking her how that program is going to work.
It does seem to be a remarkably sort of innovative approach to try to tackle this or this hideous level of sexual violence in eastern Congo. What we're hearing is that the idea is to supply women and children and even some men in the communities with tiny handheld video cameras. And the idea, I believe, is to try to record attacks in their communities and try to deter the perpetrators of sexual violence. Sexual violence, we know, is at epidemic proportions in eastern Congo. The UN calls Congo the rape capital of the world. Eastern Congo is home to Africa's worst war. And various armed groups there use rape against civilians. It is almost routine. And some of the stories that we have heard coming out from Hillary Clinton's trip have been very, very difficult to hear. It seems very, very difficult indeed that the Secretary of State said that it had been emotionally draining. So she met with President Kabila, and this is part of her agenda of trying to use America's muscle, if you like, to try to pressure leaders over human rights, especially over rights in war zones. And Eastern Congo is considered Africa's worst war. She met President Kabila, and she insisted to him that it is clear that Eastern Congo is unable to handle the scale of this shocking sexual violence. Eastern Congo is unable to handle the scale of the problem alone. So that's the idea behind this $17 million plan, which will also train doctors to deal with the injuries rape victims suffer, and also train the Congolese police officials. The Congolese police officials to deal with rape victims, and also doctors to help people in the communities as they come across people who have suffered these appalling attacks, which are widespread.
So she's handling sexual violence in the Congo. Now she's moving on to Nigeria, and that, of course, could arguably be one of the most corrupt nations in the world. This is from a resident of Nigeria talking about leadership in the country.
She said there's a poor leadership in the country. I think she's coming to tell them the fact that there's poor leadership is true, then she's welcome.
Is Hillary Clinton going there to talk to them about cleaning up the act among the government?
We're definitely expecting her to say it's quite a lot about corruption, about transparency, about electoral reform and vote rigging here in Nigeria. Nigeria is ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world. What's going to be interesting is to see what she says in public versus what she says in private. She's expected to strike quite a tough tone. We're not sure how much of that's going to be public. An awful lot of people here in Abuja are really very worried by what they see as more signs of deterioration in Nigeria's democracy than there are signs of progress. A lot of diplomats that I've been speaking to over the past couple of days have said, well, you know, we will be watching Hillary very closely because in some ways what she says will sort of set the tone for how the international community is going to look at Nigeria in the coming years. Don't forget that, you know, this is a difficult visit in some ways for Hillary. Barack Obama came to West Africa just about a month ago and he visited Ghana. And that visit to Ghana was tremendously controversial inside Nigeria.
Well, Carolyn, let's talk about that for just a moment, because in Ghana, the president said, President Barack Obama said, that what Africa needs is fewer strong men, or not strong men, but strong institutions. And in your observations of Hillary Clinton on this trip, is she carrying that message, either in public or in private, to the strong men that she's dealing with here?
Well, we've seen very little of what she has said so far here in Nigeria. The words that we've heard coming out, certainly from Congo, have been passionate and strong. So people here are certainly hoping that she will bear a tough message. You know, it is very, very clear. You mentioned Barack Obama's words in Ghana. Barack Obama also said that, you know, no businessman, no investor would want to put money into any country that skimmed, where the government skimmed 20% off the top. Now, those were very strong words indeed. A lot of people here cheered when they heard that. They want investment in this country. They want change. People are really willing and hoping that Hillary Clinton will say something. All of this outrage was expressed in chat rooms, on the internet. You know, there was a flood of feeling in Nigeria. The Nobel laureate prize-winning playwright Wole Soyinka said, you know, if Barack Obama comes to Nigeria to visit our leaders here, I will stone him. That was the level of feeling. People were intense about it. And so people are interested that Hillary Clinton is coming. It's one stop on a whistle-stop tour for her. They realize that, you know, it is just one leg. It is a courtesy call. But they're hoping that she will bear a strong message to do with corruption, and especially to do with this problem of electoral reform and vote rigging, which many people are very angered by. This government came in on elections that were considered deeply flawed. They set up an electoral reform process, and then they put a panel together with recommendations, and then that panel was cherry-picked, and many of the recommendations of the panel were ignored. And it does seem to many people here that the process of electoral reform has faltered, and that Nigeria will continue to have a violent election cycle. We're coming up to elections in 2011. People fear that nothing will change here, that elections will continue to be run by bribery, intimidation, corruption, and vote rigging. People want to hear Hillary Clinton have something to say about that. Whether she says it in public or private will be very interesting.
That was Carolyn Duffield, BBC correspondent, who spoke to us earlier this morning about Hillary Clinton's trip through Africa. Mrs. Clinton will be heading to Liberia on Thursday and then end up in Cape Verde.
Carolyn Duffield is off breathing now for the rest of the morning, I think. So tell us the issue in healthcare that you think is most important. What's the healthcare myth you most want to dispel?
My favorite healthcare myth is those absurd death panels, otherwise known as a living will, which every single person in this country, regardless of their age, should have, so that decision about how you end your life isn't left up to the bureaucrats, but is made by you. Exactly the opposite of what they're saying. I'm 36, and I've had a living will since I was 30.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we bring on the cheese. The cheese stands alone in America. That's coming up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. The House Judiciary Committee has released about 6,000 pages of documents that show that Karl Rove, the former top political advisor to George Bush, President George Bush, played a crucial role in the firings in 2006 of a number of U.S. attorneys.
Duh. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
John is shocked. Joining us is Eric Lichtblau. He's a reporter for the New York Times. Eric, these documents included interviews with Rove and also with Harriet Myers, who is one of the White House counsels. What are we learning that's new in these documents?
Well, one of the more interesting elements is the testimony of Harriet Myers, who was the White House counsel under Bush, and she kind of gently points the finger at Rove in part of her testimony. There were a lot of I don't remembers, I don't recalls in both her testimony and Rove's testimony, but she does recount an episode where Rove came back from New Mexico, where one of the fired U.S. attorneys was ruffling some feathers among the local Republicans, and Rove reported to her that there were a lot of Republicans upset with this U.S. attorney, David Iglesias, over his failure to bring more aggressive investigations, including voter fraud and corruption investigations that could implicate Democrats. And Myers, in her testimony, said Rove was very agitated, very upset about this, suggested that something needed to be done about it.
The impression that you got from her testimony was that Rove had gotten a tongue lashing from Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico, and that he was passing on his anger and frustration over the situation to Harriet Myers.
Right, right. Now, Rove, in his own testimony, said, hey, look, I was just a conduit here. I was a pass-through, just passing on complaints, and I did not intend and did not play the role of making any decisions. I saw my role as passing on these complaints to Harriet Myers, who was the White House counsel. There are other emails, hundreds and hundreds of emails within the White House, that were focused out of Rove's office, the political affairs office in the White House, in which Iglesias, in particular, in New Mexico, was the focus of ongoing consternation, and there was really a drumbeat from an even earlier point than we'd realized, from early 2005, about 18 months before Iglesias was finally fired, that he was, in the words of one of Rove's aides, was killing us in New Mexico.
So Rove's lawyer came out with a statement and said these documents show that Rove was not involved, and yet we have Congressman John Conyers with a competing statement saying these documents basically are a smoking gun. Who's right?
Well, I think they're both a little bit off the mark, and the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. I don't think that there is a smoking gun there. There are still no fingerprints on the final decision to fire Iglesias, who was the most controversial of the eight U.S. attorneys who were let go. At the same time, though, it's clear that Rove was in the middle of this, for him to say, as he said repeatedly, that his role was limited, is called into question by a number of these emails and portions of the testimony.
But Eric, quickly, anything illegal here?
You know, there's still a prosecutor up in Connecticut who's looking at that very question. The focus does not seem to be, as best we can tell, on Karl Rove, more on people like Alberto Gonzalez and other aides at the Justice Department who were involved in executing these firings and what they told Congress and whether or not they perjured themselves.
Thanks, Eric Lischblau with the New York Times. This is The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And coming up, the cheese stands alone. American cheese. It's a global phenomenon. We're going to learn about why. But we're also hearing about healthcare. If healthcare doesn't involve putting cholesterol in your bloodstream like we're going to be doing soon, what's the most important myth or issue you want to talk about?
The president is trying to teach us a civics lesson. It's no more the Obama plan than it is your plan, because he laid down guidelines and then he went to Congress. And now it's Congress's job to listen to you, and that's why they're having town hall meetings, in order to formulate a plan that will meet the president's guidelines so that he won't veto it.
Kind of lecture-y listeners this morning. Yes, 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And top news headlines coming up.
America's trade deficit is up. New numbers out this morning show it grew a bit in June. That means imports rose, and that could be another sign that the recession is starting to fade. After Typhoon Morakot, this is what Taiwan sounds like. That is a rescue helicopter moving mudslide survivors to safety. Rescuers have gotten nearly 1,000 people out alive, but hundreds more are still missing. We spoke earlier about President Obama's town hall yesterday afternoon, but other Democrats, like Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, got a tough going. She talked about it on NBC News.
I don't take that personally. It's that they don't trust government right now. And it wasn't the majority of the audience. It was a huge chunk of them. But I get that distrust. There's a lot of cynicism out there, and it's important that I get out and listen to that.
Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, that's one of the top stories we've been looking at. John?
Sorry, Celeste, I don't like to talk with my mouth full, because on Wednesdays we talk about food, and that means we usually have some to snack on. In America, we've got, and you probably understand this, plenty of this sort of thing. That's right, milk. The gentle sound of milking machines actually taking the delicious milk from goats being milked at a little place called Hartsong Farm. It was recorded by one of our guests in our segment this morning. Kathy Gunst is a food writer and radio producer. She joins us from Maine. Good morning, Kathy.
Morning.
And here in the studio is Liz Thorpe, who's vice president of the very famous Murray's Cheese right here in New York and author of the very new book, The Cheese Chronicles. Liz, good morning.
Good morning.
Basically, we've invited you here to talk about a story that maybe some have noticed looking in the grocery dairy case, but American cheese is no longer sliced and yellow and for little kid sandwiches anymore. It's become an artisanal gourmet sort of a success in its own right, taking on cheeses all around the world. And I guess you could say that cheese has followed the sort of wine industry in the United States and has become something extraordinary. Liz, what accounts for this?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that people are learning that American cheese doesn't have to be made out of vegetable oil, for one. But it's actually, it's a very quickly growing industry, and we're eating more cheese every year. Our consumption in this country is growing astronomically, and I think people are learning about real food and wanting to actually know where that comes from. So,
Kathy Gunst, there's been a long tradition of subsidizing milk and having lots and lots of milk in the United States, but it takes more than just milk to make great cheese. What else is necessary, and what else has informed this trend? And I'm going to just eat while you're talking.
Oh, well, lucky you. I hope your goat cheese goes well with your coffee. The thing that struck me, I spent the day with Valerie Jarvis at Hartsong Farm in Gilmington Iron Works, New Hampshire, a small town in southern New Hampshire. It's excruciatingly hard work. It's 365 days a year, 7 days a week. She's up at 7 in the morning milking the goats, and then again 7 at night. You can't miss it. I mean, we were there early in the morning for the morning milking. These udders are so full and bursting, and you heard sound. And what that visual really is you walk into a small room and you see the udders bursting with milk of 10 goats at a time with these suction tubes kind of pulling on their teats and milk coming out. And it's hilarious. I never saw the faces of these goats until later in the day, but I was really struck by the labor and the physical work involved.
Well, here's what Valerie told you about how much she loves what she does.
I love the goats. I get a kick out of them. They're funny. Making cheese for me is like an art form. And I remember when I first started and I first started trying to take it out and market it to the chefs. It was just like it would be if you took your art to a gallery and you were standing there waiting for people to look at it, you know. It was extremely stressful.
And Liz Thorpe, I imagine it was stressful for the first American cheesemakers who came into Murray's, which is used to buying cheese from all over the world, and trying to get Murray's to buy artisanal American cheese. What are the standouts?
Well, I mean, now there are so many. 10 years ago, we took them all because we really wanted to help them and support them, but most of them were not that good. These days, I mean, I brought you some of the standouts. For me, right now, at this moment in the year, Cabot cloth-bound cheddar is something that you have a chunk of.
That's this right here.
Yeah, uh-huh. Made by good old Cabot, the guys you see in the supermarket, but in partnership with the first aging facility that's been built in the U.S. So it's made by Cabot and then aged for 12 months.
Yeah, it's amazing.
By the sellers at Jasper Hill, and it's an English style totally different from the block cheddar we all know.
Salty,
very sharp,
creamy, but it has a lot of depth to it.
It's got those awesome toffee caramelized
notes.
Yes, it does.
That,
absolutely.
I love, and so does everyone seems to go for it.
Now, you wrote a book called The Cheese Chronicles, and that is the chronicles of these American cheesemakers getting their act together?
Yeah, it's also my chronicle. I mean, it's about leaving my normal job and getting into cheese and why I did that.
An abnormal job.
The answer is I didn't know what I was doing. But no, I did it because I loved it, and over the course of my job, I've met all these cheesemakers and farmers and spent time with them milking their goats.
Well, Kathy, let's talk about your experience with Valerie Jarvis, because she talks about something that really bears directly on the sort of marketing trend of these American cheeses. Goat cheese, you would think, wouldn't exactly compete with the yellow American slices, but listen to this.
When I first started the markets, you know, 7-8 years ago, I would have parents say to their kids when they walked to the table, oh, it's goat cheese, you won't like that. And now I have kids leading their parents to the table and saying, mommy, mommy, you know, got to get this for me. And in fact, I had a woman telling me she had a little like 4-year-old at the table a couple of weeks ago, and she said that she has to stop her because she'll eat so much of the cheese. She's like, you've already eaten $8 worth of cheese.
Yeah, Kathy Gunst, she makes a great point. I mean, this is expensive, top-of-the-line cheese here. What are some standouts in your experience?
Well, Hartsong Farm makes a whole variety of cheeses. Their fresh cheese is just fabulous. It's very spreadable like a cream cheese, but it's a very creamy consistency but tart. I have to say, I kind of feel like the odd man out at the party here. You're all munching on your cheese, but I can imagine Valerie's cheeses. She blends them with herbs, she wraps rounds of fresh goat cheese in grape leaves, and then you're supposed to throw them on your grill and barbecue them for just a few minutes.
Until
the cheese begins to ooze. It's fabulous. Oh. But she ages some very sophisticated cheeses. She has a Coeur Blanc, which is kind of ripe in the middle and creamy and oozy, but on the outside it's firm. So you cut in and you have about three different textures with each bite, and it's fabulous. I was really impressed with the sophistication. I mean, she has 100 goats. She's only on 5 acres. She's only been doing it for 10 years, but all this hard work. Her cheeses are very sophisticated.
Great. Well, I've got a little piece of goat cheese here, Liz, here in the studio, or chèvre. Right.
If you want to roll that way.
You want to describe this?
Yeah, sure. This is similar to one of the cheeses Valerie makes. This is actually from a producer in California called Cypress Grove, and the cheese is Humboldt Fog. It's one of the classics. Mary Keane started making goat cheese in 1982, and there's a chapter in the Cheese Chronicles called It's 1982, Do You Know Where Your Goats Are?, about what happened when women primarily started making cheese from milk other than cows, which really rocked the American food scene 30 years ago. So,
can people just make cheese, or do you have to be a big agribusiness?
No, I mean, certainly Valerie's a great example of how you don't have to be and how now you can actually sell your product sustainably and viably on the market, especially if you have farmers markets nearby. That's a huge boon for these small producers. But, I mean, I think the point is that more and more small producers, small cooperatives, groups of farmers, and individual producers are able to support themselves.
It's the narrative of the Cheese Chronicles, you might say. It's a book by Liz Thorpe, our guest, who's vice president of Murray's Cheese here in New York, and Kathy Gunst, food writer and radio producer up in Maine, who introduced us to the great goat cheese up there at Valerie Jarvis's farm.
Well, technology doesn't yet allow us to share the cheese through our website, but you can listen back to the segment we just did at thetakeaway.org. We're also talking about healthcare all day today. Yesterday, President Obama held a town hall in New Hampshire, and we've been asking you to weigh in. Let us know what your message is. What healthcare myth do you most want to dispel?
This is Sheila calling from Southfield, Michigan, and the truth of the matter is that there's a lot of things wrong with our healthcare system today, but having government take it over is not going to help any better. They took over our school systems, and now look where we're at.
RWB writes on our site, President Obama tried to stem the tide of disinformation with disinformation of his own. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Edley.
This is The Takeaway. On healthcare, a hopeful message from the flock.
Millions of people of faith are supporting health insurance reform.
Members of Congress, will you?
And another message, not so hopeful.
Seniors in a position of being put to death by their government.
People of faith weigh in and a discussion of government-imposed death. In the healthcare debate, nearer, my God, to what? Have faith, America. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, August 12th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by Celeste Headley. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, an opera with lyrics by Twitter. The UK's Royal Opera House is giving it a shot, and GM says their new electric Chevy Volt can get 230 miles a gallon if you're driving in the city. Does that make it worth $40,000?
We know someone who's driven it.
First, we're joined by Dr. Laurel Coleman from the Maine Medical Center, who counsels patients on end-of-life issues. Dr. Coleman, is it true that the new healthcare legislation brings seniors a little closer to God?
Well, thanks for having me. I guess to the extent that at some point we all confront issues of our own mortality, I guess that's true. But thankfully, one of the possible bills for health reform offers a discussion with a people's health care professional about advanced care planning for all people on Medicare. I think the point is to listen to seniors, their goals of care, their preferences, and provide information about options for health care.
All right, stick around, Dr. Coleman. We'll be back with you in just a minute. But first, a look at some of the morning's other top headlines.
Well, in the headlines, U.S. Marines are in tough fighting as they work to gain control of a Taliban-held town in southern Afghanistan. They want militants subdued before next week's presidential election. Some new economic numbers out just this morning. The U.S. trade deficit rose 4% to $27 billion. Now, that normally wouldn't be such great news, but it's driven by a rise in imports here, which could be another sign the recession is starting to fade.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Nigeria. She's expected to take a tough stance on corruption and electoral reform when she meets with the Nigerian president later today. And in Taiwan, rescuers have found nearly 1,000 missing people alive. Typhoon Morakot has devastated the area. Hundreds, though, are still missing, and heavy rain is slowing those rescue operations.
Asian markets dropped today. Major indices across the region are down after Wall Street suffered its biggest loss in 5 weeks. The Dow opens at 9241. The S&P opens below 1,000 at 994, and the Nasdaq kicks off at 1970. Futures trading suggests a flat opening when Wall Street gets going in about a half hour from now. We're still talking about health care here on The Takeaway. Control the message this morning. That's your challenge. Tell us the issue you think is most important, or tell us, and maybe this is even more important, the healthcare myth in the debate that you keep hearing that you most want to dispel.
This is Clyde from Michigan. My favorite myth is that America has the best healthcare in the world.
All right, a lot of calls from Michigan this morning. We love that. 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Are they supporters of yours? Are they relatives of yours, Celeste, in Detroit?
Everyone in Detroit is my relative.
Oh, my God. That's a cancel the show. We got to do a whole hour on that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. We're talking about healthcare this morning. I'm John Hockenberry with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning.
And, you know, I agonize over this. Are we contributing to the responsible debate on healthcare by showing pictures and running sound of people screaming and yelling, or are we contributing to it by taking sound bites that are maybe a little outrageous and talking about them? I don't know.
I don't know either. We are asking people to dispel myths today, which is kind of, and I you know, I wanted to give mine.
Yeah, what's your myth that you want dispelled?
We won't kill your granny.
We won't kill your granny. Well, that's actually the issue that we want to talk about in this segment. Listen to this statement from Representative Virginia Fox speaking on the floor of the House of Representatives last month, talking about an issue that she claims is in the Democratic plan, which calls for death panels, which actually will have the government determining how you die.
Republicans have a better solution that won't put the government in charge of people's health care and that ensures affordable access for all Americans and is pro-life because it will not put seniors in a position of being put to death by their government.
Well, this issue is part of the debate, and we asked Dr. Laurel Coleman to stay with us, a geriatrician and specialist on palliative care with the Maine Medical Center. We were poking fun there, suggesting that some seniors believe they're maybe a little nearer to their God in all of this debate and that the government will be enforcing some sort of rationing at the end of life. You suggested that, well, it's more complicated than that. Also with us is Amity Schles, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a columnist for Bloomberg. Amity, let me begin with you. Is this correct, this idea that the health care reform means rationing, government-imposed death, that sort of thing?
If you look at the actual legislation we're all talking about, you don't see the phrase death panel in there. No, you see some pretty mild language about that you can't even understand about directives and advanced care and rural offices helping people, and you get the general impression that there should be some standardization and discussion of this stage of life and its costs.
But isn't this discussion, and Dr. Laurel Coleman, I'll ask this to you because I imagine this is what you do in your profession, isn't there already discussion of this so-called advanced care, which is kind of a euphemism for end of the line, pal, right?
Well, it isn't actually a euphemism for end of the line. I mean, most of us, as we age, face many chronic illnesses and challenging situations. And ideally, I think that you with your physician would have an advanced care planning discussion. What are your options for healthcare? What are your preferences and goals? That's the ideal. But in reality, these conversations are rather hit and miss. They happen at hospitalizations, at nursing home admissions, and sometimes and many times never. So I think the goal of the bill is to offer an option for people to better educate them, to help them know what their options are for future healthcare choices.
As a healthcare professional, Dr. Coleman, would you welcome an organized way of having those discussions, and would you welcome cost to be one of the issues discussed?
Well, the first part of the question, I certainly welcome more awareness on behalf of both the consumers of healthcare, seniors, and the physician and nurse practitioners and PAs that participate in these discussions, that they're very valuable. You're right that I spend time doing this type of discussion with patients and families in the work that I do, and they are uniformly 100% welcomed and appreciated by families.
Dr. Laura Coleman, thank you so much for that perspective. She's a geriatrician and specialist on palliative care at the Maine Medical Center. So, Amity Schles, it suggests, at least in the view of one doctor, that these discussions need to go on more. They're going on in a happenstance way, and that healthcare reform might be a way of organizing them. Do you support that? Do you think that's where the House and Senate are heading?
Well, the question is who's in charge of these discussions?
Right.
Is it really the individual, or is it a government office? And that's what's informing the sometimes hysterical allegations that you're hearing. If there's one big authority that's making all these decisions, and seniors are in Medicare, that's their program, that suggests there'll be less choice. And that's what where the concern is. If it's an insurance company, that's also kind of a monolith, but maybe less of one, because at least in theory you can separate from your insurance company. And that's why there's this concern, especially because Medicare is a government program, so it has a certain budget, so it does have to ration its resources.
And it already does that, right?
And it already does that. And we know from experience elsewhere, as in the UK, that when a government or a single entity, but especially a government, is in charge of something like this, it will be rational and it will ration, and that means seniors will will sometimes not get the treatment because society says maybe younger people need this more. It's our decision. And, you look at places like the UK, and it is not hysterical to point out that they curtail, for example, kidney dialysis.
Well, we are far down in that debate, maybe, than some would suggest in some of the rhetoric. Amity Schles, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a columnist for Bloomberg, thanks so much. The discussion on death panels in healthcare reform, just one of the myths and issues we're trying to get to the bottom of here. Celeste?
President Obama is trying to gain some momentum in his argument about healthcare reform, maybe dispel a few of those myths himself. He's now hoping to get some support from the pulpits of America. He's gotten some religious leaders to help him push his healthcare package. We're joined by two leaders who are going to be part of a meeting with the president next week. We've got Reverend Jennifer Butler. She's a Presbyterian minister and executive director of Faith in Public Life that's helped leading this charge. Also, Rabbi David Saperstein from the Religious Action Center for Reform Judaism. Welcome to you both. Jennifer, how do you make healthcare a moral issue?
Well, it's very easy, actually. If you look at the great religious traditions, they all call for us to take care of the most vulnerable in society and to look out for the poor and the widow among us. In terms of my faith, Christianity, when Jesus spoke about his mission and what he had been called to do, he stood up in the temple and read from the scripture and said that I've come to bring good news to the poor, sight to the blind, freedom to the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of God's favor. To me, it's very clear that as moral leaders and as faith leaders, we have a responsibility to work for systems that can address the needs of all people around us, from the poor to the very wealthy.
But David, it seems to me like the devil's in the details. There's nothing in the Torah about palliative care or dialysis or, joint reconstruction. What happens when you start getting down to the details of the bills? How do you turn that into a moral argument as opposed to a political argument?
What there is in Scripture are certain moral norms that we, our God-given wisdom, can use to apply to them. So in the Jewish tradition, God is talked about as a healer, and we're told we should heal as God heals. God is described as of visiting the sick and being with the sick, and we're told we should do that as well. By the time of the Talmud 2,000 years ago, that had developed into healthcare systems and rules and requirements to provide adequate healthcare for all people. Any community that wanted to be considered a moral community had to provide healthcare, had to provide healthcare providers. These are not new ideas. So the fundamental values that underlie the call for a universal system, an accessible system, an affordable system, an effective system, that resonates with 3,000 years of the Abrahamic traditions.
How do you keep a discussion of that, though, David, from becoming a charge that if you're opposed to health care reform or opposed to government sort of taking responsibility for health care reform, that you're actually wanting your neighbor to be sick?
Good moral people can differ on the best way to go about achieving universal health care. That isn't what this debate has been about, unfortunately. This has been a very disturbing debate in terms of the civility of discourse in America here. And when people make these extraordinary accusations and allusions to fascism and Nazism and the Holocaust, what they're doing is try to take these ideas outside the free market place of ideas, John, here. So good moral people can differ. What almost all of the major faith traditions shares is the goal to get as quickly as possible to universal, affordable, accessible health care.
Jennifer, you know, there was a recent Pew study out showing that for the first time in maybe a dozen years, the majority of Americans want religion out of politics. And how do you avoid the charge that you are bringing religion even further into politics by getting involved in this healthcare debate?
I think what those poll numbers show is that people are very concerned about increasing partisanship in religion. They're concerned about the impact that has on faith, and they're concerned about the impact that that has on democracy. I don't think that people are concerned when it comes to faith leaders respecting one another's faith and entering into public discourse, lifting up moral norms from their religious traditions and having a civilized debate about policies and about moral norms that ought to apply to the way that we run this country.
Reverend Jennifer Butler is a Presbyterian minister and executive director of Faith in Public Life, and Rabbi David Saperstein, director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. Thanks.
And those are some of the pro-reform religious leaders. There's also a bunch of anti-reform religious leaders as well. That's an interesting debate.
It's true.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley.
Well, it didn't take long. Didn't take long, right? What I announced yesterday, you're a trained operatic soprano, right?
That's right.
And how long does it take to get opera stories on the show? But one day.
It took 20 hours.
Yeah.
Which was a long time.
So what do you got here?
You know, there are complaints about opera. It's in Italian. It was written by some dead white guy in the 18th century. It's too elitist.
There's English operas. I actually enjoy the opera.
I'm just saying that there's this myth out there about opera, and the Royal Opera House in London is trying to do something about that, flying in the face of the stereotype.
21st centuryizing opera is what you're saying?
That would be if you were inventing words, you would say that.
Yes.
So they are composing an opera completely from tweets.
From Twitter.
From Twitterers from around the world are sending in lyrics through Twitter to compose a new opera. And to tell us exactly how this works, we're joined by Alison Duthie. She's with the Royal Opera House. Good morning, Alison.
Hello, Celeste.
So how does this work? How are you collecting these tweets and turning them into a masterpiece?
Well, you've described it exactly there. We launched the Twitter opera last week, and we have around 350 people involved at the moment, and it's building all the time because we're delighted there's been so much interest in it, actually. And essentially, people send 140 character tweets to us on the Twitter website. You can see those on twitter.com/youropera. And those are building a storyline, which we then have a professional team of directors and composers who are looking at that ongoing dialogue online and actually extracting the narrative from that to structure a short opera, a mini opera, which will be performed at the beginning of September.
So some of the music is original, but I understand that some of it is just based on melodies that we already know, like this one.
Nuts, I love nuts, they are the potion to unlock the secrets of nature, the secrets of nature. And allow the birds to talk to us. Bang the bird drop from the sky. It's tiny.
That, of course, would be the Toreador melody from Bizet's Carmen. Are there a lot of those type of recognizable melodies in here?
Well, we're seeing how it goes. We're going to be working on it over the next month. And in fact, that was a lovely singer called Gary who worked, who just improvised yesterday in order to bring to life some of the words. But no, we will have original music. We have two composers working on it, Helen Porter and Mark Teitler. And they're going to be working over the next 3 to 4 weeks on actually realizing original music for it.
So, but Alison, that was just a taste of what's possible.
It was a taste. Absolutely. We're not going to be kind of working at the level of Bizet for this. It's very much, right. It's part of a bigger festival that we're doing, which is called Deloitte Ignite, and that runs at the beginning of September to launch the Royal Opera House season. And we ask artists to work in many ways, creating installations, and visual artists work with us, and we have events all over the building. And the Twitter Opera is one part of that. But we're just really pleased because what it does is kind of explores the interaction with our audiences, and it also looks at, I mean, exactly as Celeste said at the beginning of the article, that opera isn't a remote and elite art form. It's a genuinely living, exciting art form, and we really hope that this kind of light-hearted discussion and interaction with the art form will kind of break down some of the barriers that surround opera. And,
well, it's not so light-hearted. I mean, opera since the beginning has been this sort of multi-platform combination, yeah, of media, and you know, going all back way back to the time even before Mozart. And I do love the sort of collaborative qualities of this, and I think it's a great way to think about collaborative music. But the one thing I'm not annoyed, but you know, Twitter's an American resource, right?
An American resource.
Well, I mean, we invented Twitter in America.
Ah, okay.
Right? Yeah.
Well,
shouldn't this be an American opera? I mean, shouldn't this be something more along the lines of what Celeste and I put together this morning? I wonder if you'll take a listen. This is from Ashton Kutcher's Last Night Twitter feed. Okay, his tweets are some of the most popular in the world. He's followed by 3 million people. Here's a text that's already pretty well followed. A lot of opera stories are very well known. What do you think of this, Alison?
What are your team names?
Game on.
Bring it, Jimbo. The loser has to admit defeat on Twitter. Stay tuned.
Warming up to play some skee ball with Jimmy Fallon. Thank you, Howard. Glad you enjoyed the flick.
Congrats on the baby, Sarah. Great job of putting this together.
If you missed Kelly Ripa and Ashton, here is the link.
Regis and Kelly, you are the best.
So, Alison, I think this is
fantastic.
A pretty viable art form, don't you think?
I'm very impressed.
That again is last night's Ashton Kutcher's Twitter feed.
Yeah, a few minutes.
Yeah, I thought the story really took
great
a turn
material.
At
really
Jimmy
had
Fallon.
Dramatic potential.
I'd be delighted if Ashton wanted to send a tweet and take part in Twitter the Opera. And it is sitting in a kind of worldwide, you know, formula in a sense, because we can take tweets from all over the world, which is what's so exciting about it.
Which, speaking of taking tweets, just to go off on a tangent here, you can go to our website, the takeaway.org, and if you are a listener and you want to submit your tweets, John and I will record them as a new opera with just all you have to
talk to my agent about
tweet,
that. Hold on,
tweet them.
That sounds reasonable. But we're making some news here, Alison. You are at the Royal Opera House,
yeah,
offering Ashton Kutcher to help you compose this opera.
Well, if you would like, any the twitter.com/EuroOpera site is open to everybody, and so far we're welcoming everybody to be part of that. So yes, of course. I mean, that's the point of the piece, is that essentially it's open for development through whatever sources, whatever kind of inspired input people want to contribute. It's also going to be played. We'll film it on the 5th and 6th of September, and it'll be on the Opera House website, a film of the final piece. So of course, whoever whoever contributes can actually see the final outcome of that. And we'll also try and credit everybody on our website. So that's our aim.
Thanks, Alison. Alison Duthie is the director of the Royal Opera House's Contemporary Division. Thanks for coming on. And go to our website, because if you submit your tweets, we promise John will record a new opera with them.
Oh, just me?
That's the takeaway.org.
Bury the lead.
Now we'll take a look at some of the news stories of today.
U.S. trade deficit is up a bit. New numbers show a slight spike in June, fed by growing imports. Here, exports are also up. The new report is another potential sign that the recession is fading. The Associated Press is reporting that lawyers tell a judge that the U.S. and the Swiss have reached agreement in the UBS bank secrets case. So far, there are no details there. And staying with business news, Macy's is posting a second quarter profit. The department store chain beat expectations.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Nigeria. She's expected to talk about cutting down on corruption and graft in that country. Some of Nigeria's oil wealth has gone to corrupt politicians.
And quickly, Iraq's health ministry says 67 American troops there have H1N1 or swine flu. That must be miserable. It's getting updates from the U.S. military. That's a look at some of the top stories.
We're going to get more news from Iraq on the string of bombings in the northern part of that country that's killed over 100 people in the past few days. We'll talk to a reporter from the New York Times.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org. You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, it's The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley, here all week with John Hockenberry. A string of bombings in northern Iraq and Baghdad have killed more than 100 people in the last several days, 60 killed on Monday alone. The attacks are raising fears extremists are engaged in a sustained and organized attempt to spark ethnic and sectarian warfare. We have more now from Rod Nordland. He's the New York Times foreign correspondent in Baghdad. He reports in today's Times that the Shiites are actually actively resisting getting drawn into the violence. Rod, that's a big change from what we've seen in the past, right?
It's certainly a big change from 2006, although there was a period before then, 2004 and 5, where they were also being provoked very deliberately, and they also followed their leader's counsel not to respond. But eventually that sort of blew apart after the Samarra mosque bombing.
But there's other things that go along with this. For example, the Sunni leaders and politicians are for once, I guess, condemning the attacks on the Shiites.
Yeah, they were notable for their absence in past years when there were these outrages against Shia. They basically said nothing. In some cases, they even would claim it was justified for some reason or other, or they might possibly, or they would say often, a line you heard often in those days was that the Shia must have bombed themselves so that they could get sympathy. And now they're all speaking out about it. The leaders of groups like the Iraqi Islamic Party and other Sunnis have been pretty outspoken in condemning the violence.
So, Rod, there are two ways to look at this, at least two ways, it seems to me. On the one hand, as you may have suggested there, the insurgency has become a bona fide fringe movement affiliated not really with the Sunnis and certainly not with the Shia. And the other way of looking at it is maybe the religious authorities within the Shiite community have a greater degree of ability to enforce a sense of restraint on the part of Shiite militias.
Well, I think that's right, although there's a limit to their ability to enforce restraint. They weren't able to enforce restraint during periods of 2006 and 2007. Since then, a lot of things have changed, and it's a complicated mosaic, but part of it is the defeat of the Sadrist militias in Basra. Part of it's a general weariness with the war and anger at the militias, but a very large part of it is the respect that all Shia show for their religious leadership.
To this extent, I mean, that's a positive development, but the horrible, tragic side of this is that 157 people were killed in Iraq in the first 10 days of August. Violence is ramping up. And from what I understand, earlier on when the U.S. first left Iraq, they said the attacks were disorganized, not very sophisticated. Now Iraqi officials say the attacks have al-Qaeda fingerprints all over them and are very sophisticated, using sophisticated weaponry and detonators. And they're able to wreak incredible havoc, and they're targeting children, innocents, weddings. So the violence is increasing.
Well, actually, I mean, there's two sides of that, too. Yes, it's increasing in terms of these spectacular attacks that kill a lot of people. But the overall incidence of violence, the number of insurgent attacks of all sorts, actually decreased somewhat in July. Not a great deal. That doesn't matter that much, because it's these spectacular attacks that get everyone's attention and that are designed to get people emotional and angry and to draw a reaction, and they just have not been able to do that.
What's your best assessment, Rod? Is there a center to the insurgency, to these sort of militia violent attacks right now, or is it dispersed and diffuse?
You often hear people say that the Iraqi government even will often say it's diffuse, it's a few holdouts and so on. But in fact, it's very highly organized. And you saw that particularly on Monday, where you had car bombs, the same sort of bombs, actually, parked cars or parked trucks, going off almost like clockwork for every half hour during the morning around in different neighborhoods in Baghdad, and almost simultaneously in the north in a Shia village near Mosul. And that is just cannot be a coincidence. That's the result of planning and a high degree of organization.
Do you agree with the Iraqi official who says the attacks have al-Qaeda fingerprints on them?
I don't think there's very much doubt about that, that they're al-Qaeda. It's very hard to prove. And you know, you will still hear some people say, oh, it's something the Shia are doing to themselves. Or there are even some radical elements who believe that the Americans are doing it to prolong their stay in Iraq and give Iraqi leaders an excuse to ask them to stay longer.
Rod Nordland, New York Times foreign correspondent in Baghdad, just to remind people who we're speaking with, then if the violence isn't escalating in the sense that sectarian violence isn't being inflamed by these horrible attacks, what can you say about the coping mechanisms of the civilian population in Baghdad? Is it taking the form of, say, Sarajevo or Bosnia, where people are radically altering their day-to-day lives to simply step around what is a horrible brutality that is a daily occurrence?
Well, that was true in 2006 and 2007 and through much of 2008 even. It's no longer true. You would not have any idea that this is a city that has these horrific bombings on a regular basis simply by traveling around the city during the day. It, you know, people go about their business in a normal way. And part of the reason for that is that the incidence just is no longer high enough that everyone feels that they might personally get caught up in it. You know, it's a city of 5 million people. It covers an area the size of Los Angeles, and the normal sort of one bomb a day just really doesn't impact on most people. Even when there were this series of bombs, most neighborhoods, everything was quite normal.
That's Rod Nordland, New York Times foreign correspondent in Baghdad. And now we'll take a look at some of the morning news headlines, John.
Well, once again, U.S. Marines are in tough fighting in a southern Afghanistan town. U.S. troops stormed in by helicopter before dawn. The Taliban have held this town for years. It's got strategic value, and American forces want insurgents defeated there before next week's presidential elections.
The government wants to know why dozens of flyers were stranded on a plane for 7 hours last weekend in Minnesota. The Transportation Department is probing the Continental Express flight. Passengers weren't allowed to go back into the airport while they waited out a weather delay. And wildfires in two parts of California are forcing people out of their homes. Nearly 1,300 firefighters are battling flames in Santa Barbara County. And the far northern part of the state, another wildfire has injured firefighters.
I guess the question would be, is it a national emergency if your president gets swine flu? It's apparently not in Costa Rica. The president there, Oscar Arias, has H1N1. He's currently quarantined at home and taking anti-flu medication, but he says he feels well enough to continue working remotely. And that's a look at some of the top news stories we're covering today. It gives new meaning to the notion of presidential bubble.
That's right. It makes him look tough, doesn't it? He's still working, even though he's suffering through swine flu.
Right. He's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Coming up, the GM Volt, the Chevy Volt. Is it a game changer? There, I said it for the car market. We'll find out in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And you've heard us reporting it all morning. The president will award 16 Presidential Medals of Freedom today to people like the late Jack Kemp, Sidney Poitier, the actor, and Stephen Hawking, the scientist, Sandra Day O'Connor, former Supreme Court Justice. But you can find the entire list on our website if you like. But we've asked one of the recipients to join us for a few moments, Ambassador Nancy Goodman Brinker, founder of Susan G. Komen for the Cure, the largest breast cancer organization in the world. Ambassador, you are one of the 16 recipients. First of all, congratulations and good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, John. Good morning, Celeste. Thanks so much for having me.
Give me a sense of how the impact of your organization really dovetails with the core values of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, without being too immodest.
Well, let me say this. I think whenever you lead a mission such as this, and this has been ongoing for 30 years, you begin to feel, you watch the benchmarks, you watch the things that happen, you watch whether you're making progress, you watch your outcomes, and you plan carefully, you're very strategic. And so this is a wonderful, how shall I say it, embrace from our country for work people believe and we hold very sacred, this public trust, that we're doing the job we said we were going to do. And indeed we are. We're going to eradicate breast cancer.
Well,
all over the world.
As you say, and I can hear it in your voice, it's something you feel very, very proud of. But based on what you also said there, I can't imagine it's the thing you're most proud of in terms of the impact of your organizations and others in the fight against breast cancer. What would that be?
Well, you also have to understand this is extremely personal to me. This is the 30th year of my sister's death. I also am a breast cancer survivor, and so every day I celebrate my life that I'm allowed to live this long to do this, and look carefully and watch the people I love in this organization and celebrate their lives and sometimes have to honor their deaths, and it's a very personal mission for me. So every day I try to work very, very hard, never ask anybody else to do what I won't do. And we just go at it all the time. And I am thrilled that we have so many people around the world, millions of people now who support us and understand what we're doing. So this is a very celebratory day for us. It's also a charge to more action.
Well, is this basically a nod from the president saying, great job, Nancy? Or does this in some way help the mission of your organization?
I think both, and I think it is a nod. And I commend this president because this is really one of the first times a patient advocate and a patient advocacy organization has been so celebrated. Hmm. And this is an important trait in our society now. It's an important movement and an important activity that in many other countries people have yet to undertake. In a way, it's very American and born out of our leadership in the world. So I'm very proud to carry this medal for all of the above.
So remind me of what you said a moment ago, Ambassador Nancy Goodman Brinker. You live your life never doing anything you couldn't do yourself?
No, I don't live my life never doing in this organization what I would, never not doing what I'd ask someone else to do.
So does that mean you're not going
to
let...
Don't ever ask anybody to do what you're not prepared to do.
So does that mean you're not going to let the president pin that medal on you?
No. I mean,
all right.
Unless she
pins
one on him.
Ambassador Nancy Goodman Brinker, founder of Susan G. Komen for the Cure, one of the Presidential Medal of Freedom recipients.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, man, GM has a car that could get 230 miles per gallon.
It's so righteous.
Certainly got my attention, but is it really going to change the car market? We're going to find out in just a few minutes. But we're also hearing from you on healthcare. Control the message this morning. Tell us the issue you think is the most important or what healthcare myth you most want to dispel.
The reason it's a difficult plan is because it is difficult, because there is no perfect plan. These systems in Canada and the UK have their good points, and they have their not such good points. And I think when people realize that there is never going to be a perfect plan, and that you do have to pay for what you get, then I think that will solve things.
Done a great response. 877-8-MY-TAKE from you, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now I'll look at some of the other stories we're following today. Celeste?
The U.S. government and Swiss banking giant UBS have cut a deal. Lawyers on both sides say they've reached an agreement on a case involving secret bank accounts. The U.S. believes wealthy Americans are using the bank to dodge taxes, and they took UBS to court. Details of the deal, though, aren't out yet. Up to 70 fighters are dead after clashes between rival militant groups in Pakistan's troubled northwest. Intelligence officers say the battle is fighting between fighters supporting Batula Masood and those allied with the government. Top Taliban leader Masood is believed dead after an earlier CIA drone strike. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is expected to push for reform when she meets with Nigerian leaders today. She's in the capital to urge them to tackle corruption. And back in the U.S., it's a busy day at the White House. In about half an hour, the president and first lady will hold a reception for new Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Later, he'll award medals of freedom to outstanding people in various fields.
So, you know about these automakers, right?
I do know something of the auto. I'm from Detroit.
So I got to figure they sit around at a table, right? You know, and they have meetings. And they go, hey, you know, John, what do you say? The Volt, let's call it the Volt wagon. Huh? Do you think they consider that? You know, in talking
they
about
sound
the Volt?
Exactly like that, too. It's
the Volt, it turns out, the Chevy Volt, GM's like miracle car, is not going to be a Volkswagen. It's going to cost a lot more than that, probably about $40,000.
Well, and it won't be built, you know, by VW.
That's right. It's going to be built in America.
That's right.
And you've driven one.
I have driven one.
What was
one.
It like?
Cool.
Was it electric?
Oh, God. Yeah.
That's bad. Well, what was it like?
First of all, it's completely silent. It makes no noise. Now, the one that I drove in California used a hydrogen fuel cell.
Right, so which is different from the one that
different than the one that's being released in 2011. But the one in California, it was completely silent. It still had tons of zip and pep, and it was fun to drive.
The question this morning, is it the car of the future? Let's find out. It's going to get 230 miles per gallon. Gary Golden is with us, our friend, futurist, energy blogger. He joins us to pose the question, do you believe that 230 number, Gary?
I do believe it's an accurate assessment of the potential for city driving. And most people believe that they will be able to have triple-digit miles per gallon with typical suburban highway driving as well. But real-world driving is likely to be much below 230.
That's based on the statistic that the majority of city driving is less than 40 miles at a time.
Correct.
So if you drive less than 40 miles a time, the reason you're going to get such great gas mileage is this, because that gas engine in the Volt will never kick in. You'll be going on electric power only.
Correct. So what the game changer is really cost. So miles per gallon gets a lot of headlines, but really what General Motors should be promoting is that they've been able to drop the cost of an electric drivetrain. That's
cost
the big
story. Cost of operation. Right?
Correct. Cost of building an electric propulsion system.
And could that be the last time you say game changer?
Probably not.
Okay, probably not. Yeah, I can see by the way you look. But look, the modern day assessment of whether a car is environmentally sound involves not just looking at the car. It involves looking at the entire manufacturing process. And there are some issues with getting raw materials for batteries and electric motors and the environmental consequences of even manufacturing this vehicle. Has GM figured all that out?
I would expect that they have. There haven't been many public statements about it, but most of the batteries are actually likely to be manufactured in Asia rather than the United States. So some of those things are out of our hand. But the environmental footprint of an automobile is much greater than the fuel that you use to propel it.
and 40,000. I mean, GM needs to do something that's going to be huge here. Is bringing out a $40,000 car that they probably aren't going to be able to supply enough of to really make a difference, the real big move for GM here?
Well, it's a first-generation vehicle, so $40,000 price point is actually quite reasonable. And then we'd expect, given the government's role in General Motors today, that there will be a tax credit to bring that price down a little
further. It's at $7,500 already.
That's the expectation.
You know, I was going to ask, when the hybrids first came out, when we first saw the Prius, everyone talked about that as being a fashion accessory. It was very highly priced. All the people at Car and Driver and Consumer Reports said this is not reasonable to think of this as an environmental vehicle. Most people can't afford it. Are we going to expect the same kind of evolution with the Volt?
I would. So the benefit of the electric propulsion system is its cost over its lifetime. So it's much cheaper to run an electric vehicle over the lifetime compared to a mechanical combustion engine, which breaks down.
Well, the lifetime, though, of cars these days is 200,000 miles. Will this Volt run for 200,000 miles? Do we even know that yet?
We don't know. And the challenge with batteries in the first generation of electric vehicles is that batteries are not the end game. And what we need to be looking at is the evolution of electrification of the automobile towards hydrogen fuel cells. That's the true game changer in terms of cost.
Which they're already moving to.
Mm-hmm. So all major manufacturers, Toyota, Honda, General Motors, Kia, and Hyundai, are all now planning production volume fuel cell vehicles, which are electric vehicles, in 2015.
Well, Nissan's got something called the Leaf, which gets, it says, 367 miles per gallon. They might as well have said 2,050 miles per gallon. Nobody knows. It has no tailpipe. No gas is required. A fully electric car, which will go into production next year. Suddenly the Volt is not going to be alone.
No, we're in year zero of the electric age of the automobile. So it's a very exciting time. And I think one of the things we need to be looking at is new applications for electric vehicles. So another exciting project that General Motors has is a partnership with Segway to develop a small urban vehicle that is not owned by an individual, but actually just a service.
Segway are those little stand-up kind of scooters that you see the Target guys on, you know, the security guards
right.
at Target and controlling the
But this
parking.
Is designed with a hand controller. It feels like a golf cart, and you actually wouldn't need to own the electric vehicle. You just buy it per mile.
Isn't there something just a little bit scary about that, though? I mean, the Segway was, let's face facts, was not a big success. GM is having all kinds of problems. They come together, two fiascos.
There is something called the hype cycle, in which if something appears and you think, oh, it's going to change the world, and it doesn't, and then it falls off the map. But the Segway technology in terms of operation balance is revolutionary for mobility.
Ultimately, does GM have to sell the sexiness of being green to justify that $40,000 cost? Because in many ways, the cost of operation, just using regular fuel, if you're going to just buy a $10,000 car, it doesn't cost, you know, $30,000 a year to operate a gasoline car.
General Motors needs to sell two things. First, to the government shareholders, that it can build low-cost electric vehicles. That's what it needs to be moving towards. And then to the consumers, it needs to be selling the driving experience. So what's likely to drive General Motors' revenue in the years ahead is software, things that take that electric vehicle platform and transform the driving experience for people. So I get in and I want it to perform like a Ferrari. My wife gets in, she wants it to feel like a Cadillac. You switch something in the car using software, and it changes the driving experience.
So
that's the benefit.
Reconfigure customizations. Do you get glimpses of that in your experience, Celeste?
I loved driving that. I felt very cool driving that car. I have to admit, you would buy one. I don't have $40,000 in my checking account, but I definitely, were the price lower, I would definitely get one. I felt like I was in Coolville.
So there is a price point issue for you. I mean, you could, you know, go into debt, you know, for
well, you know,
grand.
I have a pretty reliable car, and you know, I'm not quite ready to get rid of my beloved Pontiac Vibe, but I loved the Chevy Volt. I fell in love with the Chevy Volt. Yeah.
Well, getting the Celeste Headleys off the fence, I think, is really sort of a good statement of the challenge for General Motors.
Definitely. But most people that experience electric propulsion systems describe it as a better drive than mechanical systems.
Because it's electric, okay? Gary Golden, futurist and energy blogger, talking about the Chevy Volt. It claims 230 miles per gallon, and I guess from Gary's perspective, maybe a game changer.
Is it a game changer for you, or would you feel cool in the Chevy Volt? Go to our website and weigh in on it at thetakeaway.org, and while you are there...
Regis and Kelly, you are the best.
And the crowd. crowd goes wild. You can listen fully to the operetta John and I made with lyrics from Ashton Kutcher's Twitter feed. That's on thetakeaway.org. You can also submit your tweets, and John is going to record a new opera with those
as
well.
Thanks a lot. That's
Here's
really,
your takeaway.
Really nice.
Opera isn't a remote and elite art form. It's a genuinely living, exciting art form. And we really hope that this kind of light-hearted discussion and interaction with the art form will kind of break down some of the barriers that surround opera.
That's Alison Duffy from London's Royal Opera House. We talked to her earlier today.
We're also talking about health care. We want to know the issue that you think is most important or the health care myth that you most want to dispel. You know how to reach us. It's 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.